sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and Friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Rena Rosner, author of the fantasy book The Light of the Midnight Stars. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on Two Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Two Jewish is paid for by Two Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. Since we celebrated Yom HaAtzma'ut, Israeli Independence Day, last week, I wanted to take a few moments this morning to talk about Israel. Normally on Two Jewish, we have some Israeli crisis or another to talk about regularly, or a major accomplishment of Israel's to discuss. Some of that has happened over the past pandemic year, much less than in a more normal year perhaps, but some has happened. In the past 12 months, Israel actually held not one, but two national elections, count them, although neither led to a clear majority in the Knesset, nor did it change the fact that eternally embattled Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu remains in the driver's seat of Israeli politics, as he has for the last decade. And Israel responded to the COVID-19 pandemic as actively and effectively as any non-isolated nation on earth. It has now vaccinated nearly its entire adult population and appears to have achieved herd immunity before any other country and to be returning life to normal after some draconian shutdowns that helped defeat coronavirus with far fewer casualties per capita than much larger, richer, and theoretically more advanced nations like the U.S., Britain, France, and Germany. And in the Abraham Accords, Israel signed peace treaties with the UAE and Bahrain and later Sudan and Morocco, a clear step forward in international relations for Israel in the Middle East. If not exactly a total breakthrough as it has been sometimes portrayed, the Abraham Accords is a funny name, really, since Abraham lived his entire life in what is today Iraq, Turkey, Israel, and Egypt, and never, to my knowledge, spent any of his time in Arabia, let alone sub-Saharan or far western Africa. If the name is intended to imply that all Abrahamic faiths are united by these agreements, well, Muslims, Christians, and Jews all can claim to be Abrahamic faiths, certainly Jews and Muslims, and as important as these agreements might prove to be, they surely haven't united the substantial populations of all major religions of the Middle East across all boundary lines. Still, in a year when all the news seemed either to be about COVID-19 or the U.S. elections, it was nice to have some good news from Israel. And as Israel, and soon the rest of the world, works its way back towards normalcy after this strange, stunted year, we do well to think about just where Israel is right now. I must add that I lived in Israel for a year and have traveled to Israel 15 or so times for visits of shorter duration. This marks one of the longest periods when I actually haven't been able to go in person to spend time in the Promised Land. For me, that's in decades. That makes these truly observations from afar. But of course, that's a lot of what's going on these days in every area of life until we are fully able to travel and experience the world again, which is only now becoming more possible. In general, I think that in spite of the usual fractures in Israeli society, Israel is doing extraordinarily well. Its economy was hurt badly by COVID, of course, but it will rebound quickly as things open up. It remains on the cutting edge of high-tech, online security, medical developments, medical technology development, high-tech military technologies of all sorts. And since it has moved its population to a higher and higher level of technical education and proficiency, it's in good shape in many fields. In addition, while its arts community has suffered badly from the lockdown, Israeli TV shows have taken off in the U.S., rather improbably, and provide a real source of creative impetus and financial income for Israel. Politically, Israel faces a constant threat from Iran and its proxies, but it is well ensconced in the alliance that is quietly built between Egypt, Saudi Arabia, even Oman and its new Gulf friends, the UAE and Bahrain. The Palestinians have rarely been more disorganized and ineffective. And while in the long run that means that this time there really isn't anyone to make peace with, it also means that pressure on Israel to actually do something in that direction remains very weak indeed. And of course, U.S. support for Israel is now a profoundly established fact, as is the very close alliance between our two nations. But what, you may ask, of the political morass Israel seems to find itself in, with national elections every few months and a deeply divided society? Well, I must remind you that in spite of this, Israel hasn't experienced any insurrectionist assault on the Knesset, nor is it likely to see that. It's not that the Israeli political mess isn't a mess. It certainly is. It's just that it doesn't really matter that much, to be honest, to the average Israeli, and it hasn't hurt Israel a whole lot over the course of this whole elaborate melodrama. What of the increasing divide in Israel between the large majority of secular Israelis and the Haredim, the ultra-Orthodox minority? Well, that divide has certainly come to seem more like a chasm, but the ongoing tension in that area does not presage civil war or violence. It remains at the level of harsh speech and political shenanigans. You know, I wish our own divides in America were being waged solely in words and not in insane deeds, don't you? We can perhaps learn from a small, argumentative country like Israel that you can differ with your internal neighbors substantially without needing literally to attack them. It'll be fascinating to see how things change in Israel in the next couple of years as we approach the 75th anniversary of the founding of the only Jewish state on the planet. And I firmly believe it will be a blessing to witness the continued growth, development, and flourishing of this remarkable, quite wonderful, interesting, and very real nation in the coming years. To play us in this morning, here's a classic Israeli song, Ein Li Eretz Acheret, I Have No Other Land.
Ein Li Eretz Acheret, Gam Limad Mati Boeret, Rak Mila Beivrit Choderet, El Orka El Nishmati, Shinta et panea lo avater laskirla veashir kan veoznea ad shetifkach et einea en li eretz acheret gam elimad mati boeret rak mila beivrit choder El orka el ishmati beguf koev belev ra'iv kanu beiti lo eshtok yartzi shinta et paneha lo avater lazkir la ve'ashir kan beozne
That was Galia Tari singing the classic Ehud Manor song, Ein Li Eretz Acheret, I Have No Other Land, for Israel. When we return on To Jewish in a moment, our guest, Rina Rosner, explains how she came to explore the remarkable field of Jewish fantasy literature and has created excellent work in that area herself. Find out all about it when we return in a moment here on To Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. the best games in town, amazing dining, and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the Soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a Jewish synagogue in Northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this spring. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in Northwest Tucson and the Catalina foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Beit Simcha's synagogue is located at 2270 West Ina Road, on the north side of Ina, west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall in our own building. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone in normal times. In these waning days of our coronavirus epidemic, groups can join in person Friday night and Saturday morning. Just email me to rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org, BEITSIMCHATucson.org. Or you can join us every Friday night on our Facebook page for Shabbat evening celebration services at 6:30 p.m. Saturday Shabbat morning services are at 10 a.m., all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. Facebook page is Beit Simcha Tucson, BEITSIMCHA Tucson on Facebook. We will continue to hold services with full music by virtual experience for the, well, all future, as well as our in-person, masked and careful attendees, but in growing numbers. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are available in blended format, too, on Zoom or in person. You can access them by emailing me, rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org, BEITSIMCHATucson.org. Our religious school is also available in blended format. It's time to try it out and sign up for next year. Some of our students are live, some on Zoom, but it's a wonderful school. In fact, for more information about Congregation Beit Simcha, to come to services, attend our great religious school and Torah Tikes programs, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation and high school programs, and rich array of adult education academy courses taught on Zoom and in person, and of course all of our services on Facebook and in person, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BEITSIMCHATucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675. BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the newest Jewish community and the fastest growing synagogue in all of Southern Arizona in its exciting beginning years. We are delighted to welcome to Jewish our guest this morning. Rena Rossner is the author of the fascinating new book, The Light of the Midnight Stars. I'm not sure quite how to describe it, except to say that it's a cross between a fantasy story, a little bit of magic realism, and extraordinary Jewish research and scholarship. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So let's start out with a basic question. Why did you decide to write Light of the Midnight Stars?
I think it was two things. My publisher wanted another fairy tale retelling. There's a follow-up to my first book, which is called The Sisters of the Winter Wood, which is also a very Jewish fairy tale novel. Yes, fantasy, historical fantasy also, what this one is. And also, I was trying to answer the question, why did my grandmother light Shabbat candles in the closet? Which I never thought in my lifetime, but my father and his sisters always spoke about. And that led me down a rabbit hole of research in Romania and then Hungary and then Slovakia and you know, as one does, as we happen to do in our Jewish history, it's always a question of where did you come from before that? And so that was sort of the origin of the novel.
The Solomonic aspect of it, that was completely invented by you? Is it based in a midrash somewhere? Tell us a little bit about how that came about.
Yeah, so, I mean, I discovered along these tangled routes of research that there is a sort of myth or story or legend of the Solomonars, who were like red-haired mountain men and women who could ride cloud dragons in the sky and control the weather and had all these sorts of abilities, and that this is often used as a sort of anti-Semitic trope in Romania. And I was fascinated by this idea, because who isn't fascinated by people who could ride cloud dragon in the sky? But in the process, I was like, well, Solomonars, like, well, that is obviously a reference to King Solomon. What would it look like if there was a group of people who had the magic of King Solomon in their veins? And there's a lot of stories about King Solomon, about the different abilities that he supposedly had. And, you know, one of them was to talk to animals, and another one was, you know, horticultural, like make things grow, to read the path of the stars in the sky. You know, all these various different things that are attributed to him. And those come from, yeah, different sources like Midrash and, you know, all different types of Talmudic discussions. And so it was a lot of research to figure that out, and then to be like, exactly that. Be like, what would that look like today? The same way a lot of people can trace their lineage back to being a Kohen or a Levi, right? The Levite, the priest. It's not too far a jump to be like, well, what if there was magic too?
And we will talk much more about the magic. I'm not going to mention Game of Thrones too often, I promise, in the course of this interview. When we come back with Rena Rosner, her book is called The Light of the Midnight Stars. A very entertaining, very enjoyable book. Even if you're not into fairy tales, which I am not, sadly. We'll return in just a moment with her here on Too Jewish.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at toojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's T-O-O, jewishradio18@gmail. Or visit our website, toojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there, downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store's very popular Jewish podcasts, top 10 in North America, according to Moment Magazine, over 100,000 downloads on Podbean. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Tom, there's a story out that the last Jew in Afghanistan is leaving, which is a fascinating story in itself. That community goes back well over 2,000 years. His name is Simon Tov, and the story is he's protected the synagogue in Kabul from damage, but now he's finally leaving. You have a lot to say about this.
Yes, I have so much to say. We might have to continue this next week. But the first thing I want to say is that these days you more and more hear about the last Jew in a place like Yemen or Syria, which was once a large, thriving, important Jewish community. And they're either dying out or leaving for Israel or whatever. In this case, Zvulun Simon Tov has been without his wife and daughters since 1998 when they moved to Israel. And he appointed himself as the shomer, the guardian of the last synagogue in Kabul way back then. And as other members of the community left and jumped ship during all these years of first Soviet occupation, then Taliban leadership or lack thereof, then a lot of instability and civil war. And this guy is basically afraid that if the U.S. finally pulls out as promised, the Taliban will take over and they'll destroy the synagogue that he's devoted his life to protecting and preserving. So I want to talk for a minute about the background of the Jewish community in Afghanistan, and then about my specific ties to the Simon Tov family and to this particular synagogue that will clearly eventually disappear. Jewish history in Afghanistan goes back to at least the period that followed the destruction of the First Temple,
which is 586 or so BCE.
Right. So it goes back
2,600 years.
At least 2,500 years. And According to several sources that I found, the center of the Jewish community way back then was Balkh, which is a city in northern Afghanistan, quite close to the border of current-day Uzbekistan. Of course, none of these countries existed then. In those days, Balkh was the capital of an ancient, fairly powerful kingdom called Bactria, and Bactria is what gave us the Bactrian camel, the camel with two humps.
Double-hump camel, right.
So that was the center of Jewish life before...
I rode one of those, by the way.
Cool.
In northern India.
Yeah, I prefer to stay away from camels.
It's probably a good choice.
Among other things, they have very bad breath and very foul tempers.
And
anyway,
mean, yeah.
The center of Jewish life in Afghanistan gradually moved northwest to a city called Herat, which is very close to the border of Iran and Turkmenistan. Herat was important historically because it was on the Silk Route. It was a city of merchants, and it was the first non-crazy city on the way east from the Shiite holy city of Mashhad in the far northeast of Iran. So for those two reasons, a lot of Jews settled there, and there are written records of those Jews going back at least 1,500 years. I guess we have to continue next week.
Yeah,
we ran out of time already.
Yeah, I think it's a fascinating and not well-known story of the Jews of Afghanistan. We'll continue next week. Thanks, Tom.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Avram has his first session with an eminent psychiatrist. So Avram asked the psychiatrist, "Why have you come to see me?" "Because I'm having trouble with the whole human race, doctor. They are stupid and won't listen. They call me a crazy man," says Avram. "Doesn't matter what I tell them. They say I'm meshuggah." "What do you do, doctor, when you meet stupid people who won't listen to a word of truth?" "Avram, I'm getting a little insight into your problem. Let's start from the beginning." "Thank you, doctor. Thank you," says Avram. "Someone who listens. Now, in the beginning, I created the heavens and the earth, and my spirit moved over the face of the waters." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. Now a word of Torah. This week we read the double portion of Achrei Mod and Kedoshim, which includes the Holiness Code, a description of the ethical injunctions that lie at the heart of Jewish practice. The code itself includes mitzvot, requiring us to assist the poor, treat strangers, widows, and orphans with generosity and kindness, and insist on fair business practices. It obligates us to live ethical lives. It's important that this remarkable section comes in the precise center of the middle book of the Torah, Vayikra, Leviticus. Kedoshim, the Holiness Code, is thus in the middle of the Torah. It forms the heart of the heart of our most sacred text. And at that heart is the ethical injunction to love your neighbor as you love yourself. This is an amazing and probably utopian ideal. Love your neighbor as much as you love yourself. If our society was actually rooted in such a conception, how much better it would be for everyone. In a world in which violent wars tear apart nations like Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, Myanmar, in which desperate refugees from famine and evil are turned aside from rich nations, when terrorist attacks can strike anywhere at any time, the idea of loving one's neighbor as oneself may seem particularly visionary. How can we believe in such a concept in a world in which horrible human violence can destroy anything? Can this utopian ideal of true love for all possibly be made real? In true Jewish fashion, Kedoshim does not treat this as simply an idealistic statement. It is instead made into a practical imperative. Achrei Mod Kedoshim builds up to the religious commitment with a series of ethical injunctions. Leave a corner of your field for the poor and the stranger to eat. Don't leave a stumbling block before the morally blind. Care for the widow and the orphan, be honest in your business dealings. Have equal weights and measures in your work. Be holy because God is holy. That is, be ethical because that lies at the heart of holiness. The way to love your neighbor is by treating him or her both fairly and honestly. It is that notion of the practical approach to love that is just so Jewish. We are not obligated to convert our neighbors to our own views of things. We are not obligated to save our neighbors from their own belief systems. We are not obligated to change our neighbors into carbon copies of ourselves. Rather, we are commanded to treat them as we would wish to be treated ourselves, respectfully, honorably, honestly, charitably, compassionately, generously. That is love of one's neighbor, expressed in a functional, healthy society, or a synagogue, or a Jewish community. May we all be able to live to this great ideal in the small, practical, honest ways that really matter. When we return on to Jewish, our guest, Rena Rosner explains how her new book, The Light of the Midnight Stars, combines imagined mystical Jewish writings, fantasy stories, and deep Jewish learning into a beguiling and compelling novel. Hear all about it when we return on to Jewish.
We continue with our Two Jewish Update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Prince Philip, the closest member of the British royal family to Jews and Jewish causes in all likelihood, died last week at the age of 99. Philip, married to Queen Elizabeth II for 74 years and known as the Duke of Edinburgh, supported Jewish and pro-Israel causes and did so for a long time. His mother, Princess Alice of Greece, sheltered a Jewish family during the Holocaust. She is recognized as one of fewer than 30,000 righteous among the nations by Yad Vashem, Israel's Holocaust Museum. Philip's four sisters each married German nobles, at least three of whom became Nazis, but Philip, educated in Britain, joined the Allied war effort in the Royal Navy. As an adult, he showed little patience for Nazi collaborators. He was instrumental in making a pariah of his wife's uncle Edward, who, after abdicating the throne, dallied with Nazi Germany. Philip spoke multiple times at Jewish and pro-Israel events, including Jewish National Fund events, and lent his royal sponsorship to many Jewish causes. He came under attack in the 1960s for speaking to pro-Israel groups. Famously impervious to criticism, he ignored the attacks. In 1994, Prince Philip was the first British royal to visit Israel when he accepted Yad Vashem's recognition of his mother, visiting her burial site on the Mount of Olives in Jerusalem. At Yad Vashem, Philip planted a tree in memory of his mother. She was married to Prince Andrew of Greece. They sheltered three members of the family of a late Greek Jewish politician in her palace in Athens. The Gestapo was suspicious of Alice. They even questioned her. But the princess, who was deaf, pretended not to understand their questions. Alice later became a nun. The Holocaust was the most horrific event in all Jewish history. It will remain in the memory of all future generations, Philip said at Yad Vashem. It is therefore a very generous gesture that also remembered here are the many millions of non-Jews, like my mother, who shared in your pain and anguish and did what they could in small ways to alleviate the horror. Philip's 1994 visit broke what was then an unofficial but binding ban on royals traveling to Israel. It had been enforced following attacks by Zionist fighters against British targets in the years before the establishment of the State of Israel, during the pre-state British mandate over Palestine. For all its trappings, Philip's 1994 visit was personal, not official. The Royal House did not end its policy on official visits to Israel until 2018. British have long memories, when Prince William, Philip's grandson, visited Israel. In other news, Israel will be reopening its gates to fully vaccinated tour groups on May 23rd. Israel hopes to allow individual vaccinated tourists by early July. Israel has now vaccinated most of its own population, of course. It has largely reopened public and recreational spaces while seeing the number of COVID cases plummet. It is time that Israel's unique advantage as a safe and healthy country start to assist us in recovering from the economic crisis, and not only serve other countries' economies, said Tourism Minister Orit Farkash HaKohen. Only opening the skies for international tourism will truly revive the tourism industry, restaurants, hotels, sites, tour guides, buses, and others looking to work and provide for their families. The reopening for tourists will happen in three stages. May 23rd, the country will let in a small number of tour groups, 10 to 20 a day, led by licensed tour providers. Tourists will still need to test for COVID before the flight and test for antibodies upon arrival. A few weeks after that, if case numbers stay low, the number of tour groups allowed in per day will rise. Israel hopes to reopen to individuals and families who are vaccinated. In 2019, some 4.5 million tourists visited Israel. The country's tourism industry employed 200,000 people, but Israel closed nearly all entry to foreigners with the onset of the pandemic and shut down Ben-Gurion Airport completely earlier this year due to rising case numbers. It's good to hear about Israel's reopening plans now. A dark chapter in recent Jewish history closed last week when Bernie Madoff died. Madoff, the con man who ran a $17.5 billion Ponzi scheme that ensnared thousands of investors, including a long list of important Jewish organizations, families, and individuals, died at the age of 82 in federal prison in North Carolina. Madoff was known as a selective money manager who made fantastic yet consistent profits for his clients until the whole operation blew up in the 2008 financial crisis. Madoff's confession of his Ponzi scheme, in which he invented fake stock gains on paper and used new investors to pay off withdrawals from older investors, set off an earthquake in the Jewish philanthropic world. Among Madoff's investors were European hedge funds, elderly retirees, and a large range of nonprofits. Among his victims were some of the most prominent Jewish institutions in the country, including Jewish celebrities like Holocaust survivor Elie Wiesel and Hall of Fame pitcher Sandy Koufax. Madoff's big investors included Yeshiva University, elite Orthodox Jewish day schools in New York and Boston, Hadassah, the World Zionist Organization of America, and many other Jewish organizations and family foundations. Most of those investors met Madoff through the small world of Jewish philanthropy in New York and South Florida and put their money with his fund through his friends Jeffrey Picower and J. Ezra Merkin, who operated hedge funds and invested heavily with Madoff. Merkin, a former president of Fifth Avenue Synagogue in Manhattan, directed perhaps $1 billion of congregants' money to Madoff. The consequences of Madoff's fraud reverberated through the Jewish world for many years. Some Madoff investors, like Hadassah, had withdrawn more money than they invested and were subject to clawback suits in which they had to pay back the fictitious profits. Madoff had claimed to be managing nearly $70 billion, but most of that money never actually existed. Madoff collected accolades as his apparent success grew. He was named the treasurer of Yeshiva University, the flagship modern Orthodox institution, and gained a reputation as a reserved but effective steward of Jewish organizational finances. Both of Madoff's sons died before him, one by suicide. When Madoff died, he still had 138 years to serve of his 150-year sentence. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Rena Rosner has an extensive literary career as a literary agent and author. And I guess, there's probably not too much you haven't done in the field of literature. Her new book is called The Light of the Midnight Stars. Tell us a little bit about how you moved from kind of working in literature to publishing yourself.
I've been a writer and a reader for as long as I can remember. It was a dream of mine to publish novels, to be a writer from age 8. And so definitely the writing came first. I already in high school, I was working in a bookstore. I'm from Miami Beach, Florida, originally. So I used to work at Books and Books, which is one of the the last long-standing, not just independent bookstore. And
might be the last standing independent bookstore eventually, but...
It's also one of the most successful independent bookstore chains.
Yeah, that's right.
So, yeah, so I grew up working at Books and Books, and I knew that I wanted to study writing in university. You know, so this is something that's been threading my whole life. It took me a while to find the literary agency, but never, you know, the writing was always there. I was always, I didn't start writing my first novel until I was about in my 30s, I think. It took a while for me to get there. You know, I was doing short stories and poems. I've always been a poet. The literary agent thing, I've been doing a bunch of different things here in Israel. I've lived here in Israel now for about 16, 17 years. And I feel like there's a track that a lot of like English speakers in the literary world follow here. You work for nonprofits or you work for newspapers and journalism or you do the grant writing or, you know, so I did that track. or you edit for academic presses or stuff like that. And at a certain point, I had my fifth child and I was on maternity leave and I didn't want to go back to work unless it was something I really wanted to do. And my husband was like, well, what would that be? And I said, well, I want to be a literary agent and work at the Deborah Harris Agency in Jerusalem. And he was like, that's really oddly specific. but I used to pass... I used to pass the agency on my way to take my kids to the dentist, and I would just sigh every time I passed the door because I knew what they were. You know, we represent David Grossman and Meir Shalev and Tom Segev and the estate of Yehuda Amichai, and I mean, and on and on and on. And it's the premier literary agency in Israel. And my husband was like, well, why don't you apply for a job? And I said, they're not looking for anyone. And he's like, right, so just don't apply and you'll never get the job.
Absolute good advice.
And good advice. So I sent that for my resume, and it's just total cold, you know, call. She didn't know me from anybody. And but I'd had 10 years of working in the field here. I knew a lot of people from working in journalism and in nonprofit and all that. And she took one look at my resume and said, can you start tomorrow? And that was that. So I've now been a literary agent for 10 years. And all along, I've been trying to get books published. I have two novels that I wrote and were agents in and went to acquisitions at different houses and never sold before The Sisters of the Winterwood. But eventually it sold. I think a lot of people think that because I'm a literary agent, it makes it easier for me to get my books published. Anybody who knows publishing knows that's like absolutely not true. Publishing is still publishing. Publishing is really hard to break into. You still got to do the work. And it happened to be that, but, you know, it all came together at the same time. But yeah, I've been trying to get a book published for as long as I can remember.
You know, Judaism has a very interesting relationship with magic. Sometimes downright hostile, sometimes elaborately embracing it. It's very ambivalent.
Absolutely. I think that was one of the biggest challenges. So, you know, growing up, I've been reading fantasy my whole life. When I was a kid, I mean, teens today have, and younger kids as well, have a tremendous wealth of fantasy stories to choose from. But when I was younger, there wasn't this genre that we call YA now. It isn't even a genre. It's more like an age range, category of age. But at a very young age, was already going to the adult fantasy shelves because that's what there was to read.
Yeah. Yeah, there was no Harry Potter in those days.
And the only person sort of fit that space was Tamar Pierce's Alanna book. But otherwise, I was reading Robert Jordan, and I was reading... it was also a wonderful golden age for fairy tales, like Terry Wendling and Alan Kushner and Celia Sherman. And, I mean, there were a lot of these... Tamlin was written by Pamela Dean. There were a lot of fairy tale retellings happening in those years. It was like late 80s, early 90s. That I was reading, and so that was a huge inspiration for me. Even Jane Yolen wrote Briar Rose in those days, and these books like were a lifeblood to me, especially Jane Yolen's Briar Rose, because here was someone who had, even though it was a Holocaust story, had put Jewish fantasy, you know, had done Jewish fantasy. But I never saw myself reflected on those pages as an Orthodox Jewish teen, you know, even just as a Jewish woman or man. There are no main characters in fantasy that are Jewish in those days. And so it was a dream of mine to one day be able to write fantasy. But it took me a while to get to it because I think I had so much respect for the masters and the great names in the game, in the science fiction and fantasy space, that I was afraid to add my voice. I was like, what can I add to the fantasy space? And it took me a while to get to it and to realize, okay, I know what I can add. And that was the Sisters of Winterwood. But in terms of Judaism and magic, it's true. I mean, I grew up with the sort of, like, parable in my head that, like, at a certain point, the great sages decided that, like, magic and, you know, was no longer a prophecy, right, was taken from the Jewish people. That's what, like, I grew up hearing. That, that prophecy was something we once had, but no longer.
Not since Malachi, right? I mean, not since Malachi, the last of the prophets, and ever since then, it's just been a matter of interpreting revealed text.
Right. And the truth is, the further you go back in history, and it wasn't necessarily, we don't have a belief that God took prophecy away, even though that's what I was raised on. It was just a bunch of rabbis who decided one day, like, we're not going to do this anymore. This is as far as I can tell. And if you go back in history, there are so many books about cosmology and about, so like what we were forbidden to do was blood and bone magic, and necromancy, but basically other than that, it was open season, and there are so many examples of these different types of like geomancy, like casting sand or rocks on a table to read your fortunes in it, or oleomancy and oligomancy. There's all these different legalomancy, like pouring oil on water, dropping lead in water. There's even in Jerusalem, in one of the old neighborhoods here, there's an old woman I've heard stories of who still will drop lead in water and read the shapes and tell you your future. So I think it's there. We've just sort of like lost touch with it. And there's a vast wealth of ideas as spring points for discussion and writing. If you just look for them.
You know, it's funny because you're certainly absolutely right. But then you know, the stories of the golems, and so much of Kabbalah has all kinds of aspects of sorcery and revealing the future and connecting to divine forces that go beyond anything that we can see. The Hasidic tradition of these rabbis telling the future or being able to do miracles and going up to heaven and all that stuff, it's kind of right around the edge there, but it never quite crosses over, at least officially, into magic.
Yeah, I think that a lot of the Hasidic tales that, you know, are out there, a lot of them, they're miracle tales, and that's actually what they're called. Like, they're stories about people who are miraculously healed, or, you know, a rabbi who can miraculously make it from one place to another, like in that, what we call it, the Kfitzat Hadarach, right? Like the, in a miraculous amount of time, to jump from one place to another. And
right. And
I just think we haven't been calling them these things by the right name. They are magical tales.
Absolutely.
This is magic.
So in The Light of the Midnight Stars, you journey through a part of the world where people tend to think that there are strange things coming out of the forest all the time. Your heroines are females, women with incredible powers, right? With remarkable magical powers. How did you decide that was what their individual skill sets were going to be, if you will?
So part of it was based on doing a lot of research into like Romanian fairy tales and mythology and folklore, because my grandmother was Romanian, and again, the book doesn't end up sort of being set there. It's partly set there, but it's more in what is now Slovakia.
Yeah.
But again, the tangled threads of Jewish history, and where are you from before that, and where are you from before that, and where
right.
are you actually from, lead us in a lot of different directions we don't always, anticipate. But I think that it was, first of all, for me, it's always about writing women back into the story throughout history, for the most part. Unfortunately, across all cultures and languages, women were never the ones writing the stories down, right?
Right.
And so very often they were excluded from those stories. And so the only way that I have to kind of learn about what Jewish women in the past is to invent them, because they're really very, most of the time is no other way, especially in the time period that I chose to write this book, which is Black Plague Europe.
Good times in Europe, then.
No extant first-person testimony by Jewish women in this time. And so, to a certain degree, look, any novel writing is fantasy, right? It's invention. Anytime you write a novel, even if you write it about yesterday, I'm still inventing characters, inventing something that, you know, might have happened but didn't exactly happen, and, you know, and somebody else might have seen it a different way. And so I think that when you open yourself up to fantasy, you have room to play within history, and room to invent. And so for me, it was always going to be women, you know, and sisters. The more sisters I have, the more women I can insert into history. So that's a part of it. But in terms of their powers, it was a combination of these, you know, tangled webs of mythology and folklore. There's a really famous Romanian poem called, I think it's called Luceferal, which is about this comet or star that falls from the sky and a young girl who falls in love with it. And it's a tragic tale. It was written and rewritten by many different people in Romanian history. Mihai Eminescu, who's one of Romania's like foremost poets, wrote about it. And so that, you know, combined with, okay, well, King Solomon could, they say he could read the path of the stars and read the future in the stars, or even change the position of the stars. So I was like, okay, so that's one. And that was the first one that came to me. Okay. I also just love the idea of, like, a girl who falls in love with a star, you know. And so that was one. And then the other two sort of grew from, both my two and my sisters can shift. One of the sisters can shift it into animal form, and so, you know, Solomon talks to animals. It came from that, and then, well, which animals? You know, so then you look into Romanian mythology and mythology of the region, and what are the you know, totems there? What are the things that were you? What are the touchstones? Right? You know, so it was kind of this sort of a combination of, you know, the Jewish elements, but also like the local Romanian folktales that would have been, you know, alive around at that time, or that are most commonly mentioned now. And, you know, nothing's ever perfect. And, you know, even the rabbi that I based the story on, who's Rabbi Isaac of Chernava, Rabbi Isaac Chernow, he lived in about the 1500s. And my book ends up being set earlier than that. You know, it's historical fantasy, which means I have a lot of room to play. But there was no other person I could sort of, like, tie the story to, and so it's him, or a version of him and his daughters. But there are real stories about him, not as being magical. But he did write a real book, which is what I based my book of the Solomon Hours on. I remember when I was writing that, there was a sort of, I called a friend of mine who was a rabbi, and I said, can I write my own holy book? He was like, that's a strange question. And I was like, well, what would it look like if I, you know, read all these various texts and sort of made my own version based on them? And so that was what I did. It was a really fun experience to do that, too. So all those things sort of came together to create my characters.
You know, I was going to say, your book of the Solomon Hours, there's parts of it that verge on sounding a lot like Zohar, so... I kind of want a copy of the book of the Solomon Hours now, having finished your novel.
Well, I did have to write a lot more than the chapter, the quote, you know, that I used. So there's more there. But it was based on Rabbi Isaac of Chernava, or Rabbi Isaac Chernow's Book of Hagim, which, as far as I know, doesn't really exist in English. I was translating from the Hebrew in the original. And what was fascinating about that book was that, you know, it was written in the 1500s, or earlier, depends. There's a lot of, there's, you know, different opinions, as always. There
of
is
course.
Judaism,
but, of course.
It was fascinating to me how similar the practices are to Judaism today. The book, for the most part, is about, you know, on this Shabbat, you read from this portion of the Torah, from this chapter to that chapter, and then do you say Tachanun, or do you pray this way, or what do you do if Shabbat falls out on a holiday, and all these conversations and questions that just feel absolutely relevant to Judaism today. And it was crazy to me to think how little has changed, you know, how our tradition, you know, how people 500, 600, 700 years ago.
We're doing exactly the same thing. Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for just a great interview here. Where can people go to find out more about you and to get the book?
Well, they can find out more about me on my website, www.renarosner.com. Also really active on social media, on Twitter, I'm at Rena Rosner. Also same thing on Instagram. And the book is out. It's available anywhere books are sold, on Amazon or, you know, in local independent bookstores. There's a great new online independent website called bookshop.org. And
Always like hearing about new independent places to get books. Thank you so much. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week. Our guest will be Manu Rosen, a very interesting Silicon Valley star whose memoir about his grandfather's incredible story in Germany and Israel and his mother's work to expose it is called If Anyone Calls, Tell Them That I Died. Our playout this morning comes from the Platt Brothers, their arrangement of Ahavat Olam, the evening prayer of God's love for us. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of health and peace.
Ahavat Olam, Eitz Yisrael, Amcha Ahavta, Torah u'mitzvot, Chukim u'mishpatim, Otam.
sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.